From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the AU reacting to the crisis in Burundi, plight of African migrants on their way to Europe, President Obama's Gulf Summit, plus relations between Washington and Moscow. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Burundi's presidential office says that President Pierre Nkurunziza is back in the country, saying that a military coup attempt while he was in Tanzania has failed. Mr. Nkurunziza's office said Thursday the president salutes the army, the police, and Burundian people. It also says security forces are looking for the coup leaders so they can be brought to justice. It is not yet possible to verify if the president has returned to Burundi or exactly what is happening there. Meantime, the African Union says it will send human rights observers to Burundi, where fighting escalated on Thursday after that coup attempt. Marta Bonderwolf reports now from AU headquarters in Addis Ababa.
The worsening situation in Burundi led to the African Union Peace and Security Council holding an emergency meeting Thursday. Council Chairperson Ambassador Diallo Amina Djibo said several decisions were made.
The Peace and Security Council today had decided to quickly deploy the human rights observer in Burundi to help analyzing the situation and helping the civil population.
The African Union would not specify how many observers would be deployed or when. The general behind Wednesday's coup attempt had said the borders are closed. The African Union had dispatched a high-level delegation of the Panel of the Wise to Burundi last weekend in an attempt to find a peaceful solution to the country's political turmoil. The coup attempt by former intelligence chief General Godefroid Niyombare happened while President Pierre Nkurunziza was in Tanzania for an East African summit on the Burundi situation. The East African leaders said elections should be postponed until free and fair voting can take place, refugees can safely return, and all parties cease violence. But fighting has increased since the coup attempt, and it is not clear whether the president's supporters or opponents are in charge. Djibo says the Peace and Security Council is against any form of unconstitutional change.
The PSC strongly condemns any attempts seizing power through violence and attempt against peace. The PSC has also called to the Burundian stakeholders to cease-fire as urgent as possible, to create the environment for dialogue, to peacefully resolve the crisis through peaceful and legal means.
The AU Peace and Security Council did not impose a deadline for when a peaceful environment has to be created or what actions will be taken if the situation gets worse. Protests erupted in Burundi last month when President Nkurunziza announced he would run for a third term. Critics say a third term would be unlawful, but the country's constitutional court ruled in favor of the president. At least 14 protesters have been killed during clashes with police, and tens of thousands of Burundians have fled the country. Marta van der Wolf for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
Doctors Without Borders says members of an armed militia raped women en masse in Congo earlier this month after attacking a town in the eastern South Kivu province. The charity group said Thursday it had treated 127 rape victims between the ages of 14 to 70 who came forward in the days after the May 1st attack. The victims said they were raped in the morning after the attack on the town of Kikamba in the Shabunda region. The victims told Doctors Without Borders about 60 armed men looted homes, assaulted men and women, and forced 30 children to help them carry off stolen goods. Rape has long been used as a weapon of war in eastern Congo, which has been mired in conflict for more than two decades. A total of 245 migrants arrived in the port of Lampedusa, Italy, following rescue operations on Thursday. Italian Border Police Lieutenant Leonardo Ioffo said they carried out the rescue along with the Italian Navy about 50 kilometers off the Libyan coast and then were taking the people. to the Italian island of Lampedusa. The lieutenant also said migrants had to be taken to other locations as well because the Lampedusa Migrant Center was full.
A seguito di un primo triage medico effettuato dal personale sanitario del CISOM a bordo.
He also said each migrant underwent medical checks to see if they required any special medical attention. He said that women and children were the first to be rescued. Photographs released by the Italian border police showed a wooden vessel crowded with migrants at sea and a police patrol boat approaching the vessel in one of the rescue operations. Nine times more migrants have died so far this year in the Mediterranean crossings compared to the same time last year. Authorities say the transit from Libya to Italy is by far the deadliest for migrants crowded onto boats. Despite a ceasefire in Yemen, both sides report continued fighting, that is. Saudi military spokesperson General Ahmed Asiri says that coalition forces have not responded to what he called numerous provocations by Yemen's Houthi rebels, including the shelling of Saudi territory in several places. However, Yemen news reports are indicating that bombing raids did occur by Saudi aircraft. Edward Uranian is in our Middle East Bureau with more.
News media Thursday reported Houthi rebel militiamen fired tank shells and rockets at Sunni tribal fighters in Yemen's third largest city of Taiz overnight in one of several reported violations of a humanitarian ceasefire. Saudi-owned Al Arabiya TV reported that Houthi militiamen also shelled their opponents in the port city of Aden, in Dala, in Lauder, and in Marib. The Houthi's Al Masira TV said that Saudi planes bombed a market in Hodeidah and a civilian vehicle in northern Saada province, killing several people. VOA could not independently verify the claims. Al Masira TV also claimed that Houthi militiamen were firing back at snipers and al-Qaeda militants who were attacking their positions in Taiz. Saudi military spokesman General Ahmed Asiri told Arab media that the Saudi-led coalition was intent on observing the ceasefire despite what he called the Houthis' repeated violations, but that the coalition's patience could run out. He says that the Houthis should be more concerned about the welfare of the Yemeni people and observe the humanitarian ceasefire, which began Tuesday. He insists that the Saudi-led coalition's patience in holding its fire could run out at some point. On his first visit to Yemen, United Nations envoy Ismail Ould Sheikh Ahmed told reporters that he hoped the truce would hold despite a number of violations because the Yemeni people need a respite from fighting. He says that we are trying to find a formula to put an end to the political crisis and the humanitarian catastrophe. He argues that the humanitarian truce is holding despite a number of serious violations and that he still remains optimistic. Washington-based Middle East analyst Sigurd Neubauer tells VOA that the ceasefire appears to be successful in delivering aid to a number of places so far.
Despite the opposing parties accusing one another of violations, we have seen that humanitarian supplies have been successfully delivered, whether that is through Djibouti, whether that is by shipment to the port of Hodeidah, or even Doctors Without Borders had successfully dispatched plane loads with supplies to Sana.
Neubauer says there are some positive signs from the short current ceasefire, creating hope that it may be possible to hold further peace talks if the parties exercise a bit of political will. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
President Obama has reassured Gulf Arab partners the United States will stand by them against external attacks and deepen security cooperation against threats that include Iran and violent extremists. Mr. Obama met with the leaders at a summit at Camp David, the presidential retreat outside of Washington on Thursday. VOA White House correspondent Luis Ramirez reports.
The reassurances fell short of the formal defense agreement that some Gulf countries wanted, but they contained the message they wanted to hear from President Obama at a time when the nations feel threatened by Iran's role in the region and by the rise of extremist groups. President Obama called the summit a success. His pledge to Gulf partners was clear.
The United States will stand by our GCC partners against external attack and will deepen and extend the cooperation that we have when it comes to many challenges that exist in the region.
To back that commitment, the president laid out a list of areas where the U.S. will boost its already robust cooperation with the militaries of Gulf Arab states, more joint exercises, sped-up weapons sales, and U.S. help to build a more coordinated missile defense system. A joint statement issued at the end of the summit said the U.S. is prepared to work with the Gulf states to deter and confront an external threat to the territorial integrity of any of the Gulf partners. The statement, like the summit itself, is meant to address concerns among Gulf nations that the U.S. is disengaged from the region in the midst of Iranian threats. The Gulf states are skeptical of President Obama's efforts to reach a nuclear deal with Iran, and the U.S. leader spent much of Thursday explaining his view that an agreement, if it happens, will make the whole region safer. President Obama said Gulf leaders did not hide their concerns that a nuclear deal could help Iran fund even more turmoil in their region.
A number of them did express the concern that with additional resources through the reduction in sanctions, that was it possible that Iran would siphon off a lot of these resources into more destabilizing activity?
U.S. officials say the president's reassurance is a more robust commitment than the U.S. has with most of its other partners. The summit was off to a rough start, with only two of the six Gulf states sending heads of state. The Saudi king canceled his trip in what was widely interpreted as a snub. But the Saudi foreign minister late Thursday appeared upbeat and called it an extremely productive day. He said his government will wait and follow the nuclear negotiations before judging them. Luis Ramirez, VOA News, at the White House.
Islamic State militants have released an audio message they say is from its leader, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, who has not been seen or heard from in months. The message urges Muslims to take up arms in its cause and immigrate to the caliphate it has proclaimed in areas of Syria and Iraq. He says there is no excuse for any Muslim, in his words, not to join the Islamic State's war. Western news agencies were unable to independently or immediately verify whether the voice was al-Baghdadi's. The last audio message purportedly from al-Baghdadi was released in November, days after Iraqi officials said he was wounded in an airstrike on an Iraqi town near the Syrian border. On Wednesday, Iraq's defense ministry said a coalition airstrike had killed the Islamic State's deputy commander.
From the ordinary to the extraordinary, you never know what in the world will happen next.
The world is watching with grave concern as Russia has positioned its military.
You should not allow anyone to deprive you of your right to determine the future.
We are using this against terrorist groups coming from Turkey.
With a landing on
and
civilians.
Sponsored by, no, we are not killing civilians.
This with is all that's happening, VOA News works to keep you up to date every hour of every day. So when you want to know what's new, you know what to do. Tune in your radio or click on the internet. World News on the hour, every hour, or at your convenience at voanews.com.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry's meeting this week with Russian President Vladimir Putin has raised hopes of a possible thaw in bilateral relations after reaching a post-Cold War low over the situation in Ukraine. Political analysts, however, say stark differences do remain between Washington and Moscow, and the situation in Ukraine is still tenuous. VOA's Daniel Scherf reports now from Moscow.
Political analysts agree the four-hour meeting between Secretary Kerry and President Putin was a step up in contact between the U.S. and Russia. Despite tensions over Ukraine, the two sides hold regular discussions, including president-to-president phone calls and numerous meetings between their top diplomats. The director of the Carnegie Moscow Center, Dmitry Trenin, says, however, the face-to-face talks with Mr. Putin, believed to be the only real decision-maker in the Kremlin, are more significant.
Well, I don't expect a thaw in the relationship. I think that the
The differences are pretty serious. They cannot be bridged in one meeting. Something more has to happen. But it's important that at least the dialogue has been elevated to that level.
Kerry's last meeting with Mr. Putin was in 2013, before relations soured over Russia's granting asylum to former National Security Agency contractor Edward Snowden. Snowden leaked classified information on a massive U.S. electronic spying program before fleeing to Moscow. Relations then dropped to a new low over the Kremlin's annexation of Crimea and ongoing military support for pro-Russia rebels in eastern Ukraine. The last year of clashes with Ukrainian government forces has left around 7,000 people dead, most of them civilians caught in the crossfire. Trenin says the fallout between Washington and Moscow also affected peace efforts on Syria, where a four-year civil war has left more than 200,000 people dead.
I think that at that point they were really thinking about producing the level of interaction between the United States and Russia that would make it possible to stop the conflict in Syria and start the rehabilitation of the country. Unfortunately, we lost 2 years.
At a joint press briefing following the Sochi meeting, Kerry and Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov struck distinctly conciliatory tones, including on the issue of Ukraine. While disagreeing on how the conflict started, they acknowledged both Kiev and the rebels have been violating the ceasefire and vowed to use their influence to stop the fighting. Pavel Felgengauer, a defense analyst and columnist with Novaya Gazeta newspaper in Moscow, argues the Kremlin does not need to use its influence because it is the one giving orders.
Of course, these are, of course, to some extent proxy forces, but they're under Russian threat military command and their logistics are all controlled by the Russian military. And they don't have, I mean, and if they do as they're ordered. If they shoot, the orders come from Moscow. If they don't shoot, the orders also come from Moscow.
Despite mounting evidence, Russian authorities consistently deny they are offering arms or troops to the rebels. The meeting came as fears rise of a possible new surge in fighting between Russia-backed rebels and government forces near Ukraine's port city of Mariupol. International monitors with the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe document sporadic fighting and a buildup of tanks and other military hardware, especially on the rebels' side. Some analysts believe the rebels want to not only take Mariupol to have access to the sea, but also territory further west to form a land bridge linking Russia to Crimea. Trenin argues the buildup is defensive and says the Russia-backed rebels are preparing for any Ukrainian attempts to retake lost territory.
Anyone who is thinking about rebuilding the economy of a region would need to look at Mariupol. So it's very important for the rebel leadership in Donetsk. However, having said all that, I believe that President Putin has very real control over rebel actions of that kind. No major offensive, I don't think, is possible in that part of Ukraine, absent a Russian nod or Russian acquiescence. And this, I don't think, will be given under the present circumstances.
Trenin says the Kremlin is pushing for the West to accept its authority over Crimea in exchange for accepting Ukrainian authority over the rebel-held southeast, known as the Donbass. Observers note Crimea was not raised at the joint press conference. Analysts, however, say Western governments and Kiev are not likely to give in to Russian pressure, as it would legitimize its violation of international law. German Chancellor Angela Merkel, in a visit to Moscow Sunday, called the annexation of Crimea criminal. And despite the diplomatic gestures, military analyst Felgengauer believes the Kremlin is preparing the rebels for a new offensive. He says resources going into backing the rebels instead of economic development indicate a surge in fighting is inevitable and argues Russia wants more than just Mariupol.
The real issue is not Crimea, not Donbass, it's the entirety of Ukraine. Russia wants all of Ukraine, not Mariupol, not Donbass, and not only Crimea, all of it, as a Russian proxy, and will not settle for less.
Felgengauer argues the Kremlin is always open for dialogue and negotiations with the West, but it will not compromise on the issue of returning Ukraine to its sphere of influence. The crisis in Ukraine was sparked when Russia-leaning President Viktor Yanukovych abruptly pulled out of a trade deal with the European Union in favor of one with Russia. A popular uprising last year against his government in Kiev turned into bloody street clashes and sniper fire. Mr. Yanukovych fled to Russia, and as a Western-backed interim government came to power, the Kremlin seized Crimea and began supporting rebels in the east. Daniel Scherf, VOA News, Moscow.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia, debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. You can listen to Encounter on Saturdays and Sundays. That's Encounter, every Saturday and Sunday, on the Voice of America.
And it is time now for a look at what's happening in the world of business.
This is BizBeat.
If you have a car, lower oil prices means cheaper gas. In the U.S., you now save $10 on a 13-gallon tank from a year ago. But for countries relying heavily on oil exports, the drop means lost revenue. During the 2008 global financial crisis, Africa was spared major damage, mostly because of its underdeveloped financial markets. But today, the continent's a victim of plunging oil prices. Nigeria and Angola are the largest oil-producing countries, and oil companies there will now have to consider if they want to move ahead with billion-dollar projects that need higher oil prices to make a profit. And while most consumers enjoy the lower prices at the pump, social safety nets in less diversified economies are at risk. Less money for HIV prevention, for example, less buying power for imported goods, and loss of revenue for governments fighting extremist groups like Boko Haram. What's an economy to do? Economists say become more diversified. For VOA's BizBeat, I'm Philip Alexio.
And in other news, European Central Bank Chief Mario Draghi said the ECB's economic stimulus program is working, but needs more time to bring European inflation back to healthier levels and restore consumer and business confidence. He spoke on Thursday at the International Monetary Fund here in Washington. Earlier this week, the 19 countries that use the euro currency reported the fastest economic growth in 2 years. Eurozone consumer prices stopped falling last year. Inflation report reduced fears that the region was in danger of slipping into a growth-killing spiral in which consumers put off spending because they expect future prices will be a lot lower. But Mr. Draghi was not ready to declare victory over Europe's long struggle with economic stagnation. Also in the news, the Bank of England's governor has said that a promised in-out referendum on Britain's membership in the European Union should take place as soon as possible. Mark Carney says that the many businesses that have not yet acted on that uncertainty are continuing to invest and hire. He told the BBC on Thursday that clarity in the process is in the interest of everyone. Carney said access to the European marketplace is one of the biggest advantages of the British economy. The EU is also the largest investor in Britain. Prime Minister David Cameron had pledged to hold a national vote on whether Britain should leave the EU before the end of 2017. He said that during his campaigning up to last week's election, which he won. Some analysts say the issue is one of the most important challenges facing the Cameron government in the next 5 years. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on International Edition on The Voice of America. It's always good to have you with us. You know, if you happen to want to discuss what's going on in the news and you find yourself on Twitter, you can find me there also. I'm at VOA Norman. Twitter, always a good place to check out things. And you can find the latest world news on our website at voanews.com. I hope you'll stay tuned. It's coming up very shortly, the latest world news. You don't want to miss that. And for our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Jimmy Cook, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. We hope you have a great Friday.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondent. a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live, anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Gunfire is rocking Burundi's capital, Bujumbura, as rival factions of the Central African nation's security forces confront each other following the May 13th announcement by Major General Niyombare that he had taken control of the government. The announcement occurred while President Nkurunziza was in Tanzania for a summit of the East African Community, where leaders were addressing the crisis that has beset Burundi since the April 25th announcement by the ruling party of the candidacy of President Nkurunziza for a third term, despite the provisions in the 2000 Arusha peace agreement limiting presidents to two terms. The announcement triggered street protests, mainly in the capital, Bujumbura, that the police tried to repress with water cannons, tear gas, and live ammunition. An estimated 20 people were killed, hundreds injured, and hundreds detained during the 2 weeks of protests. Intimidation and violence by the ruling party's youth militia in advance of the planned May 26th legislative and June 26th presidential elections have been cited by some of the over 60,000 Burundian refugees as the reason for seeking safety in neighboring countries since the end of March. The United States has been following the situation closely and deplores the violence now gripping Bujumbura. In nominating the president for a third term, Burundi's ruling party missed an historic opportunity to advance democracy. The United States calls on all parties to immediately end the violence and exercise restraint. We support the East African Community leaders' call on May 13th for peaceful democratic elections in line with Burundi's electoral laws and the spirit of the Arusha Agreement that ended the nation's devastating civil war. We urge all stakeholders to take the steps necessary to create the conditions required for peaceful, timely, credible, and transparent elections and to respect the rule of law, including those provisions of Burundian law regarding civilian rule. We are deeply concerned about reports of Burundian military involvement in the violent events in Bujumbura. Under the Leahy Law, the United States cannot provide U.S. military assistance or training to Burundian military units that have committed gross violations of human rights. It is essential for all Burundians, both military and civilian, to uphold the spirit of the Arusha Agreement and reject violence. The United States will continue to monitor the situation in Burundi closely and will, as appropriate, refuse U.S. visas to those who participate in, plan, or order violence against the civilian population.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Need a little straight talk? Want to make sense of the world around you? Ask a question. Hear what others have to say? If so, Voice of America has a variety of talk shows for you. Lifestyle, health, politics, youth, sports. We have it all. Tune into our discussion shows on the radio, TV, or the internet. They examine a wide variety of issues and world events not always covered by other media. VOA.